Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Well, turnips, you know, they're kind of a forgotten vegetable, an old-timey vegetable, but they are delicious.
Especially when prepared with some local maple syrup. Last week, we talked about tapping maple trees. This week, Chef Daniel Orr is cooking with the sweet stuff. We have a side dish and a dessert. Farmers could have another thing to worry about as the global climate continues to change: invasive weeds. Harvest Public Media speculates why these plants might thrive in a warmer world. Author Nicole Hun says if your gluten-free baked good isn't as delicious as its gluten-full counterpart, you're doing something wrong, and she can help you fix it. And Keith Romaine wants to turn his neighborhood into a baking destination with a wood-fired oven in his backyard. Let's get to the week's food news. First thing, here's Lou Anne Johnson.
As global diets change, they are actually becoming more similar. This could spell disaster as humans worldwide become dependent on a few super crops, like potatoes, wheat, and corn. Researchers with the International Center for Tropical Agriculture compiled 50 years of research to see if they could track how global diets are changing. What they found was global food similarity had grown by about 36%. Increasing reliance on potatoes, wheat, corn, and soybeans has meant many indigenous crops to Asia and Africa, like millet and sorghum, are beginning to disappear. Over-reliance on a few staple foods makes the food supply more vulnerable. If disease or disaster were to strike a major food, the impact would be enormous. Processed foods are also gaining popularity worldwide, and diet-related diseases like obesity and diabetes are on the rise from the Americas to Asia. However, within individual nations' borders, diets are becoming more diverse. The Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, or WIC, provides $7 billion in food vouchers annually to those in need. The program's list of allowable foods is being revised significantly for the first time since 1980. As recommended by the Institute of Medicine, recent reforms include reducing saturated fats and fruit juices and increasing access to more fruits and vegetables, whole grains, yogurt, and fish. What it doesn't include is white potatoes, much to the chagrin of the potato industry. The USDA has stood firm, saying that although white potatoes have a place in a healthy diet, typically the women supported by the program purchase enough white potatoes. And a team of high-tech researchers in Tasmania has concocted a unique way to tackle the mystery of mass bee deaths around the globe. They're gluing tiny homing devices to the backs of thousands of bees, hoping to catch clues in the insects' behavior. Some beekeepers have reported losses of 40 to 100% from an elusive phenomenon known as colony collapse disorder. The cause of the die-offs is unknown, but culprits include neonicotinoid pesticides, varroa mites, viruses, or cell phone towers. And the answer is likely a recipe of multiple factors. At the Commonwealth Scientific Industrial Research Organization, scientists hope that the data from 5,000 sensor-toting bees will help solve the riddle. The team first chills the bees to make them sleepy, then shaves their fuzzy backs with tiny razors, and glues on a 2.5 millimeter square device. Then the bees are released into the relatively pristine backyards of Tasmania, which is especially suited as a controlled environment. Another hive, outfitted the same way, is exposed to neonic pesticides, and according to Paulo de Souza, the project's lead scientist, the effects are disorientation. The bees behave inconsistently, taking much longer to come back to the hive and longer to leave the feeding stations. Over the next 5 years, the team plans to make smaller and more advanced sensors to boost data collection. Breakthroughs in battery power and communication would allow researchers to track hives around the world in a central database. Ultimately, the group hopes to develop a tracker the size of a grain of pollen, capable of detecting temperature, moisture, and wavelengths of light, as well as the bee's position. See pictures of a bee outfitted with one of these trackers on our website. More info about all these news stories is at eartheats.org.
Our weekly news update with Lou Anne Johnson.
Thanks, Annie.
Most climate models paint a bleak picture for the Great Plains a century from now. Scientists say it'll be warmer and the air will be more rich with carbon dioxide. To what degree is still unclear, but even small fluctuations in climate throw farmland ecosystems out of whack. A new study shows certain invasive plant species will not only be able to withstand climate change, but thrive. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon has more.
So how about if we go this way?
Ellen Nelson has a weed problem. In the summer, one hillside of her small ranch near Bellevue, Colorado, turns bright yellow. The culprit? A tall, rubbery weed called Dalmatian toadflax.
See, there's these little rosettes. Just this much starts up in the fall.
Nelson pushes aside a layer of brown grass and snow to uncover the hibernating plant. It first shot out its showy golden flowers more than a decade ago on her property where she raises grass-fed beef. The plant is a pain. It crowds out native grasses that her cattle actually like to eat.
And it's such a tough, waxy plant that by the time it really gets going, the herbicide, you just can't get the herbicide in it.
The expensive herbicide is a relatively new weapon for Nelson. It's already cost her thousands of dollars. At first, she tried pulling the toad flax by hand, but the roots go deep and they can quickly regenerate. Then she brought in hundreds of weevils. They burrow deep and weaken the plant, but don't kill it outright. Lately, she's been putting her faith in her steers, convincing them toad flax doesn't taste so bad.
You kind of have to teach them about a new plant. I've gotten some of them to eat some, but in general, that's a hard one.
And each method has only worked marginally well. Nelson admits, so far, the toad flax is winning. As time progresses and climate change takes hold, it's likely to only get worse, not just for Nelson, but for ranchers across the Midwest and Rocky Mountain regions.
Right, there's Dalmatian toad flax.
U.S. Department of Agriculture researcher Dana Blumenthal wanted to know what effect climate change will have on large swaths of grassland. For about 8 years, Blumenthal and his team simulated a possible future climate, warmer and more concentrated with carbon dioxide, in the Wyoming grassland. Under those conditions, Dalmatian toad flax flourished, growing in size 13-fold.
The simplest reason that invasive species are likely to do well under future conditions is that they are pretty much by definition good at dealing with change.
And that's why Dalmatian toad flax could be emblematic of an even larger problem. Invasive species are invasive because they can adapt quickly. Similar studies across the country have shown other nasty weeds like yellow star thistle, red brome, and cheatgrass do well in warmer, more CO2-heavy conditions. But scientists need more data to make solid predictions.
There are going to be cases of invasive species, some of which we care a lot about, becoming much more problematic. And there are going to be cases of invasive species retreating from areas where they now exist. We don't know enough to say how common this is going to be yet.
It's an ecological balancing act, and ranchers face expensive headaches when weeds outcompete native grasses.
We are just treading water at the moment.
Steve Ryder is with the state of Colorado's Noxious Weed Management Program. He says, like managers in most states, his focus is on keeping new weeds out. If he has time left over, he goes after smaller populations that are quickly becoming problems, almost like stamping out spot wildfires. He says he's already stretched thin, and some weeds have gained a foothold.
If climate change is going to accelerate that, then we need to decide whether we're going to accelerate the response.
Rosa!
Back at Ellen Nelson's ranch outside Bellevue, she's formulating this year's plan of attack against Dalmatian toad flax. It'll likely be a mix of herbicide and burrowing bugs.
I mean, maybe we're going to have to learn how to live with some of these weeds. I don't know. That might be heretical to say.
But if the climate gets more and more hospitable to noxious weeds, it's heresy that many of her fellow ranchers will have to get used to. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration focused on issues of food, fuel, and field. More stories like this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. Last week, it was all about collecting maple sap and how it's something more of us could be doing. Today, it's all about using the finished product, the syrup, in your cooking. To the kitchen, first thing today, obviously, maple syrup in dessert is a must, so we've got one of those. First, Chef Daniel Orr uses it to cut the bitterness in a root veggie you might still have stored away in your cellar.
Well, turnips, you know, they're kind of a forgotten vegetable, old-timey vegetable, but they are delicious. And we're going to do something more kind of Hoosier and down-home using Tim Burton's maple syrup. So what you need to do is pick out a nice turnip. They should be shiny. See how that it's kind of shiny, and if you feel the texture of it, very, very smooth. If it's wrinkly and soft, then it's not going to be good. It's going to become kind of bitter from being in storage too long. So basically with the turnip bulb, what we're going to do is dice it up. I would say about half-inch pieces, and then steam it off. And you'll come up with a turnip much like this. Now, this is a little hot, but if you want to taste it, it should still be a little bit crunchy.
You just throw this in your mouth. It's so hot. Oh, my God. Okay, crunchy. Well,
crunchy. All right, so we have these ready. They're cooked. They're hot. They're kind of steaming. Now we're going to put together the sauce for them. So just a touch of oil, minced onions, teaspoon, garlic. Just going to let those become a little tender. We don't want them to be super soft. And I'm going to throw a couple dried chili peppers. We're going to leave them whole, and that way we can take them out. So if you're wanting to get a chili flavor, but you don't want to have it too hot, so that's always a good trick. I just added about 2 tablespoons of maple syrup. And now I'm going to add some chopped kumquats. I've got 4 kumquats. They look like little tiny oranges. And you can eat the whole thing. You can eat the skin and all. You can squeeze out the seeds, but I even eat the seeds. And they've got a really nice perfumey orange flavor. Okay, we're going to dump our turnips in. And that's about 1 large turnip. This would be enough for a side vegetable for probably 4 people. And finally, just to make it a little bit better, we got my butter. And the butter is going to enrobe the turnips, give them a nice shine. Okay, I got the sweetness, touch of spice, I get that little bit of orange flavor. I'm going to throw in some greens just to make them look pretty. This is some chopped parsley and scallions. I'm going to put these out on a plate. You can give them a try.
Yep, that's a great way to prepare turnips. This dish has Southern Indiana written all over it. The recipe at eartheats.org. A new chef to introduce for another maple-infused dish. This is Emily Bolin, the pastry chef at Farm Bloomington. She's been cooking professionally for 4 years, but her cooking roots go back a lot farther than that.
I was a stay-at-home mother, and all I did was watch the Food Network channel and cook at home and gained 80 pounds doing it. And my husband said, why don't you do this for a living, because you rock. And so we went to school, and I went to pastry school, and here I am.
Okay, so what are you making for me today?
This is our maple spiced creme brulee.
What I'm looking at, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 egg yolks. I see no white in sight.
No, it is all egg yolks, just for to stabilize it. And I have 1/2 cup of sugar, just white plain sugar, and you whisk that in as well. And then we have 1 quart of steamed cream on the stove. You just want to slowly add your heavy cream so that you don't cook and coagulate your egg yolks. So then we don't have scrambled eggs. Now I'm going to add 1 tablespoon of vanilla, just to give it some nice flavor. It'll help pull the maple out. And then we have 1 teaspoon of Chef D's sweet seasoning, clove, allspice, cinnamon, nutmeg.
Whisking, ever whisking, ever whisking.
Yes. You want everything mixed together so that every bite tastes the same.
Chef's philosophy when he's cooking savory stuff is he wants every bite to be a little bit different. Not so with pastry.
No, more so in baked custards. You want it all to taste the same and flowy. Next, I'm going to add 1/3 cup of the maple syrup.
And I see, what do I see? Little lemon chunks in there? Lemon zest?
Yes. Lemon especially will help bring the cinnamon and the sweetness out. And it just makes everything taste better when you add lemon.
I agree with you. I agree.
And now our mixture is done. It's really easy just to make that up, and it looks really runny. You'll think, how on earth will this bake together? But it does, I promise.
and you have a lighter. Just a regular old light. Whoa! And then Chef comes with a torch.
You just want to sprinkle your sugar over your brulee. You just want it to kind of fill in all your little nooks and crannies on the brulee and kind of sink down in. It makes a nice little crust. Light our torch. You're just trying to lightly toast your sugar. Just a nice little candy color.
How's it looking?
It's looking really good.
And tasting as good as it looks, but don't take our word for it. Pictures on the website, the recipes there as well. Give it a shot for your next big family dinner, eartheats.org. The second half of our show is all about the art of baking.
It's nice to see my artwork on people's walls, but it's easier to make a living if they eat the art.
We observe Keith Romaine as he creates his edible masterpieces. Chef Daniel Orr shares his grandma's biscuit recipe. And Nicole Hun gets gluten-free with her bread. Don't fear the bread baking, people. Our experts are here to help. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Bloomington Hypnosis, with certified hypnotist and self-hypnosis instructor John Hunkler, helping clients relax into weight loss for health and fitness. Bloomington Hypnosis, 812-200-5005. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
My main thing, the reason I get up in the morning, other than the fact that I have two dogs, a cat, and children, is to disprove the idea that gluten-free food is only going to be good for gluten-free and not better.
Author Nicole Hun. When I have gluten-free bread, I'm not gluten-free myself, but when I have it, I know I'm eating it because it's more dense than the breads that I'm used to. Is there any way to get around that?
Are you kidding? Is that like the best softball question I've ever gotten?
She is the author of the cookbook Gluten-Free on a Shoestring Bakes Bread.
You shouldn't know. If you know, it's not good enough. Full stop.
Hun says the recipes in her book create bread that is indistinguishable from its gluten-full counterparts. Here's a one-minute pep talk with gluten-free baker and author Nicole Hun.
I really want people to raise their expectations. I want people to understand that if you can make it with gluten, we can make it without. And, you know, that's not necessarily the case with everything that you remove from your diet. I find that dairy is a lot harder to replace than gluten because the substitutes really just aren't that great, the ones that are available. But gluten-free, all you should do without is the gluten. Everything else should be fair game. Anything that you remember, because I think that's a large part of what upsets people when they first have to go gluten-free is they feel like they have to live without, and you do not. People often define their diets by whether or not they eat carbs, right? And what they're really talking about is bread. And if you decide that you don't want to eat bread because you want to eat low carb or no carb or anything like that, that should be a decision that you make that's a true choice. It shouldn't be something that you have to back into because you feel like it's not available. You should be making a choice from a position of strength, not a position of fear.
Thank you so much, Nicole. This has been
Thank
such
you,
a pleasure.
Annie. Likewise.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Connect with Nicole Hun on her website and see lots of gluten-free recipes at glutenfreeonashoestring.com. Now in the kitchen to actually do some baking, here's Chef Orr.
A lot of people get nervous whenever they bake, especially yeast breads and raised rolls. But you got to start somewhere, and why not with biscuits or pancakes? I'm going to show you the recipe for my grandma's buttermilk biscuits. It's a fourth-generation recipe that's been in my family in southern Indiana. We used to feed the farmhands that when they come in from the fields. Now you better hold it just for the weekends and enjoy them once a month. So the flour's chilled. I've got these nice pea-sized pieces of butter. Sometimes I even put them in the freezer just to make sure they're really nice and ice cold. Okay, we're going to add our salt, baking soda, baking powder, and sugar. And the recipe is as simple as that. Now what we're going to do is just kind of mix all those ingredients together. And then I'm going to take my biscuit cutter and just start cutting up those pieces of butter until it becomes almost like a coarse cornmeal. And the reason you want the butter coarse is it's actually going to melt and steam, and that's going to give some part of your rise to your biscuits, so they're nice, light, and fluffy. So once we have this fairly coarsely cut up, and there's still some nice big chunks of butter in there, we're going to add our buttermilk. If you don't have buttermilk, you can take regular milk and just add about a tablespoon of vinegar per cup, and that will instantly turn your milk into buttermilk. I'm going to add about 3/4 of the milk in, and then I'm just going to kind of toss the mixture together, and you're just going to mix it enough to bring the dough together. You don't want to overmix it. You don't want to heat the dough up. Okay, and that's about a perfect dough. You can see the butter chunk still inside. You haven't overworked it. We're going to put it down on the counter with a little bit of flour. Pat it out till it's about the same thickness as your dough cutter. You don't want to twist your cutter, because what that will do is it will break up your little layers of butter that we spoke about earlier. So when you look at the biscuit, you should see those nice layers of butter on the inside. And then what you always want to do is to make sure at the end you have some scraps like this. And those you just kind of break up and you cook those on the side, and those are for the cook. And then we'll have some wonderful biscuits to have our apple butter on.
Or fruit preserves that you canned last summer, maybe. This recipe could become a family favorite. We're pretty sure about that. Make it this weekend. EarthEats.org for the recipe.
All right, and there they are. Aren't they beautiful?
Baking is a scientific exercise. As compared to savory cooking, there's less room for experimentation and spontaneity and, well, art. Although Keith Romaine probably wouldn't buy into that, he's found that bread baking can be an artistic outlet. He has a vision of getting his neighbors to pick up some dough as well by building a community wood-fired oven in his backyard. I visited him as he was in the midst of some intense bread baking. Take a listen.
Breaking bread is a very old term for communion, of like bringing community together. My name's Keith Romaine. I'm an artist. I've been a professional artist since 1973. I've been making a living since then.
So this idea for the wood-fired oven, this community wood-fired oven, were you just thinking for yourself as a baker, gosh, I really wish I had something like that?
At first, yes. But then in reading about it, what became obvious is that I can make a whole lot of bread. And then I start talking to friends. Amy Roche, she's connected with Community Orchard. And she was sort of like, well, why don't we just put on Facebook, put a call out, see who's interested. And so we had a meeting, and I expected one person to be there, Amy. But there were 10 people there. And they were all like, yeah, this is something we've been wanting. We've been wanting a place to bake. Oh, here, you get to watch the whole process here now. This is ready. So basically, it's you take a rye flour or whole wheat flour or all-purpose white. You mix that about half by weight of flour and half water. And then you mix it with your hands. And you your hands aren't particularly clean when you do it. Like, you don't disinfect your hands or anything like that, because the bacteria, what they did some research on San Francisco sourdough, and so they looked all over San Francisco to find this bacteria, like where is it, or the yeast, and they couldn't find it. It was it wasn't on the ground or in the air or any place, but it was on people. It was on our skin and somewhat in our bodies. And it's sort of like, oh, there's this relationship that we have with bread. Okay.
Can we leave this, first of all? Can we walk away from this?
Yes. We have 11 minutes.
In order to make this truly a community oven, there's going to be some sort of level of education that's going to have to happen, right?
Yeah, very much on a number of levels. One is to help people to just bake. Like, there's no place to learn how to do this here. And then I would like this whole process of having a bread oven as a business, and especially in neighborhoods where people don't have much money and they need an income. And this is potentially a really good income if you're willing to work. Oh, here, you can look at it in between. And see the...
Oh, it's starting to brown up.
And it'll turn a darker brown. That's where the flavors get really much stronger. What people did in communities, different bakers would use the oven on different days to make all the bread that they needed. And then afterwards, you can roast, you can make pastries, you can make pizzas, you can make, you can roast meat. Because they heat up, you use a wood fire in them, and it's like a fireplace, and you heat it up to about 700-800 degrees inside. And it has very thick masonry walls, 18 to 24 inches thick. And that holds the heat. And it holds it for about 4 hours at 500 degrees.
So let me see if I'm understanding this correctly. You'll fire it, you'll bake bread, and then over the next several days, you'll do other stuff like pastries and meat.
Right.
How's it looking?
It's looking really, really good. Oops, I got it. I think that one of the biggest reasons for doing the bread oven is the community, my community has been so supportive of doing this and excited about it. And it's fun to be in the middle of something that's exciting. When I made my artwork, I would make it and hope that somebody liked it and it would be expensive. And this is really inexpensive, and it's like the best artwork I've ever made. And then people eat it, and they like it, and they enjoy it. And it's just really, I mean, it's nice to see my artwork on people's walls, but it's easier to make a living if they eat the art.
And then you're going to bake two more?
Yep. Okay. Preheat it to 500 again, and stick those in.
What a fun afternoon that was, hanging out with Keith Romaine in his kitchen as he baked some bread. More information about his plans for that backyard wood-fired oven at eartheats.org. And send us your baking stories, questions, and photos. Our email address is eartheats@gmail.com. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ayabon Binder, Emily Bolin, Chad Bouchard, Lauren Glaba, Nicole Hun, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Keith Romaine, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Bloomington Hypnosis, with certified hypnotist and self-hypnosis instructor John Hunkler, helping clients relax into weight loss for health and fitness. Bloomington Hypnosis, 812-200-5005. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Recipes, interviews, and news at eartheats.org. Thank you for being here today. I'm Annie Corrigan.